Yeah, well, yes, I think pretty much. Okay, well, anyway, today is December 8th, 2016, and we're going to do a little visit and discussion of memories with Dan Elgin. And really, Dan, I think my first memory of you is when I was coaching at St. Joseph Farley. And you came to some practices to help us scrimmage against some of the guys. You remember
God, I don't, Bob.
that?
You will. It's probably, I probably will as you go along here.
But I remember that was my first memory of meeting you and that sort of thing. You were a student at Loras, right, at that time?
Yeah.
What year did you get out of Loras?
I graduated in 65.
Okay, 65, and when you upon graduation, you had some career choices. What did you decide to do?
Well, actually, I went into teaching because the reason I come up with was I had spent so much money at that time anyway, for a college education at Loras that I wanted to put what I had learned to be able to help others. And teaching seemed to be the profession that I went, and that's really the only reason I ever went into teaching, and the only reason I ever went to college. I had no idea I was going to go to college until the principal from Farley St. Joe's said I had to take Latin too with senior girls, Bob Wolf and I. Remember Bob Wolf?
Yes, oh yeah.
I says, "Well, I don't want to take Latin too. It ain't Michael Houghton one." She says, "Well, you got the ability to go to college, and you got to have 2 years of a foreign language to get into college. So you're taking it, or you're not going to be graduating from Farley St. Joe's." So that's how I got into college, and then I majored in economics and didn't really know what to do with it other than get into some type of teaching. And I applied two places, and Father Hemesath was the one that called me.
Father John.
Father John, super. He was a pretty sharp
Yeah.
priest, you know. And I'll never forget the interview I had with him. He showed me the school. When we got right down to the end, he says, "I got one more question to ask you." He says, "Did you graduate from Loras with a 4.0? And I says, "No." He never asked me what I graduated with. But I said, "Why were you concerned?" He says, "Because I found out that teachers that have a 4.0 have a hard time bringing the material down to the average student."
You got
And he says,
the
"Well,
right answer."
yeah, so he says, "You're hired." Actually, I took Jim McCarthy's place. You remember
Okay.
Jim?
Well, I mean, I still have a contact with Jim.
Do you?
Oh, yeah.
Because he left that spring, and then they needed a basketball coach, and Father Hemesoff called me.
Because he went to West Dubuque. No, wait a minute.
No,
he went to Auchan DeSales.
Right, he left the area.
And then he went back, came back to West Dubuque.
Yeah.
So,
And so that was the only time I had to apply for a job. It was St. Joe's in Dubuque and then over at Keeler. And after that, the jobs that I had, which was only two after that, I had got a call. Drexler is the one that called me and
Okay.
said, "I've heard some things about you. There's an opening if you like Western Dubuque." And then Mead called me for Beckman. So
Well,
I don't even know how to do a sheet, with all your stuff on it and dead and all that stuff,
So, okay, you came into West Dubuque as what?
I came in as a social studies teacher, and I taught behavioral studies, and then I taught world history, which I'm qualified in all social studies, but I've never had a world history course in my life. So thank God for Mike Coffey, because he gave me his lesson plans and everything, and I stayed 15 minutes ahead of the students. And then Jim O'Meara, I think he was assistant principal that time,
Yeah, he was.
and he called me in and says, "Dan, I heard that you taught psychology up at Leo," because I put it in up at Leo, and West Dubuque didn't have it yet. And so he says, "Would you like to teach psychology?" "Oh yeah," I said, "anything to get out of world history." So then after that's the two courses I taught for the rest of my career at Western Dubuque.
So that was, what year was that you came with West Dubuque?
Well, see, I was like a counselor up at Leo under Western Dubuque too
Right, I
for
remember
like three,
that.
4 years. But I came down to Western Dubuque, I think it was 78 or 79, somewhere in there, 76.
That was right about the time I came to the high school in 78. I think somewhere, yeah, 78.
Wait, did you take O'Meara's?
No, not really. I'm trying to think. I came in when Buck retired. That was
afterwards then, because I was there before Buck retired.
Yeah. And
that's a whole story.
there's a whole lot of stories. But also you also coached at Holy Cross, of course.
Yeah, I coached basketball, baseball. And I put in cross country up there.
Okay.
And I put in track. Had no experience.
What'd you run?
Yeah, we just run around the baseball diamond. And then I did have one student, a gal, his first name. He qualified for the long jump. I mean, he could really jump, and I didn't have any skills or any knowledge on how to teach track. You know, just other schools were putting it in, so I helped him with it, you know. And then pretty soon, Jerry Rowling came in. Well, then he took over all the sports.
Okay.
You know, I didn't have to.
So Jerry was there together with you at some point?
Yeah, just the last year or two. And then the big issue was, you know, was Leo going to keep going? And so when Drexler called, it was a big decision. I loved it at Leo High because we had faculty parties once a month, and we had fresh-made glazed donuts by the cook, and we played volleyball with the nuns, the younger nuns, and we just had a great time. So it was tough to make. But then in talking to a few of the people from up around Holy Cross, Balltown area, they said, you know, I think they could have had a public school up there if they'd have got together, but they were split. Some of them were convinced they could only have a Catholic school at Holy Cross. And Drexler was willing to go up there. But the other one spotted so much that finally Drexler says, well, we're not going to do it. So now they have little or nothing up there now. You know?
Yeah, it's amazing. When I visited with Wayne, and he was the one, of course, that was charged with putting this whole thing together back in the late 50s. And he said, I went around to all the areas and basically visited with people at the country schools, because that's pretty much what all there was, and about getting together as a district, and which they did, but then they had to become a viable district. They had to have 300 students. Well, the problem with back then was that the kids all went to parochial schools.
Right.
So he got 300 kids, but he had to get 500 and some square miles of area.
Oh, that's all coming
to put that together.
Oh,
that's why it's the largest political, geographical landmass in Iowa.
Yeah,
is because of the need for that beginning number. So, and of course we all know, within 10 years of the start of the district, all the parochial schools were
going under,
folding, and all of a sudden at the doorstep was all the kids, and then of course buying all the portables and all the business and whatever.
God, you remember when we had as many as 1,100 in the school over at Epworth, and then we had people come off the street, and they were the supervisors of the study halls. Remember those days?
Yeah.
What a zoo. It's funny, any learning went on at all. And then the one thing I'll never forget is the grading system that we had when we started down there. If you got, what the heck was it? If you got a D or C or something, was it a C at the quarter, you couldn't possibly give the student an F by the end of the semester?
I remember that.
Don't you?
No, I wasn't there for that.
Okay, because we had students then that they would work to get that C or C minus or D, whatever it was now. And then the second quarter, they didn't have to do a dang thing. Because they knew finally his teacher said, this is stupid, you know. And so then we had to change that. But yeah, that was at one time, that was a grading system.
So when you came to the high school at Epworth, then were you in a regular classroom inside, or were you in a portable? Or?
Oh, geez. I had a portable outside with World History.
Okay.
And then I also, then the next year when I put in psychology, then I had a portable outside for psychology.
Okay.
And I don't know how many years I was in that. And then eventually I, did I end up having psych? Well, then eventually I ended up with psychology next to the band room, and then when they added on back there.
Okay, right. Yeah. No,
yeah. Yeah. And then for a while I was also up at that the old weight room or whatever it was up in the northern part there by the cafeteria.
Yeah. A little room?
Well, no, it was a big room with the curtain between.
Oh, okay.
Paul Schrammel's on one side.
That, that was originally the wrestling room.
Yeah. And I remember one time, Paul and I went down, Harold Knudsen was principal. When we went down, we wanted him to put a wall in because it was just too noisy.
I remember that.
Remember that? Remember what I did to get the wall at all?
How did that all go?
Harold was going to come in, and he was going to evaluate me. So I went over and I talked to Paul. I says, Paul, you got to order a film. And I says, you got to put the movie projector right here. And Paul says, well, why? And I says, well, right on the other side of the curtain is where I got an empty desk where Harold Knudsen's going to have to sit. And I says, Paul, pretend your students all have hearing aids and they can't hear. And I says, turn that sucker wide open. So he cranked it up. And Harold sat back there against that curtain, you know. Afterwards, when he did the follow-up evaluation, I says, any comments or anything like that? He says, geez, Dan, he says, I didn't realize it was that much noise coming through the curtain from the other side. The next year we had a wall.
Yeah, I remember that very vividly. That was just one of the challenges we were faced with at the high school, and all those attempts we made to try to get bond issues passed. And lack of success there for the most part. But
can you imagine if they had started this 1 cent sales tax way back then?
Oh,
we'd have had less hassle with Beckman, everything, you know, that had been doing so good. But
just imagine, good example, we used to have, we still do maybe, I don't know, we had the parent-teacher conferences in the gym.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but at the end of every session, we'd tear everything down because we had to practice the next morning at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
And on it went. And all that energy that we had to expend to do whatever with less, it was amazing.
Well, we had to have kids practicing over at Divine Word Seminary, and I remember LaSance was in charge of the freshman boys, or was it girls? Anyway, they had a walkover, and I raised my fury about that. You know, that they were walking in the cold weather and everything, you know. And what a mess, you know.
Well, then also at the Epworth Elementary, they practiced up there all the time. And
the old school? The one with the pole in the end?
Yes.
I remember playing in that. God, I wonder more people didn't get head concussions running into that.
Well, I never was exposed to that. You were, right?
I played in that gym. My God, you know. It was absolutely unreal. And if you happen to trip, you go right into the, on the one end, you go right into the stands, you know. On the other end, you go right into the wall.
Yeah.
I think we had, maybe just one. I'm trying to think. See, I came as a sophomore to Far East St. Joe's.
Okay.
So it must have been a freshman then when I'd have played, because then they had the new school open when I was, no, how was that? So I was at Far East St. Joe's. When did the main school at Western Dubuque start?
62, 63, I believe.
Okay, because then I would have played in that, Yeah. I don't remember now, but I remember playing in the old gym.
Okay.
And I played for Farley St. Joe's.
So did you start at Bankston then and go to?
I went to Bankston, and my freshman year we had 5 kids in the freshman class. We had 26 in the whole high school, so we had them all in the same room. And all the seniors sat by the windows, and then the juniors, then the sophomores, and then the freshmen, and they decided to close the school. And then when we went to Farley, of course, you know, our classes then were like, I think I had 26 in my graduating class. And then we played basketball my first year over there. We played down in Memorial Hall. That's where we had basketball, yeah.
Okay.
Because in my 4 years of high school, I never played other than varsity basketball. I was always on the varsity, freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior. My freshman year, we won the Archdiocese tournament in Dubuque.
Okay.
We had Ralph Gatto, who scored 2,000 and some points in his high school career.
Yeah, pretty much a legendary figure.
Oh, my gosh, he was awesome, you know. So then that sophomore year, I played with varsity and junior and senior. So we had a great time. You know, we had a fun class.
And there was always the road trips, you know, that back then where you didn't have a bus, you had to take cars and all kinds of experiences in the weather and that sort of stuff. And
well, heck, when we first got married, we lived in Balltown, and I taught up at Leal, and I drove the school bus with the students from Balltown up to Holy Cross, and then I drive them home. So
when did you get, when did you connect with Grace?
Well, that was in 70, so what was it? I'm trying to think. But 68, 69, somewhere in there.
Okay, so then you got married in...
I don't even remember that. I can't remember the exact date. But she started... 73. She went through nurse's training.
But she went, then you lived in Balltown.
Yeah, right after that, for 2 years. And then my brother got killed that time. So then it was a choice, and my older brother or I had to come over and help my sister-in-law with her three kids. And my older brother's wife says, no damn way am I moving out to the farm. So then Grace and I moved out to the farm. And my dad had passed away the year before. So then my mom moved to Dubuque in a mobile home. And so then that's why we ended up being farmers.
Okay.
Otherwise, we had a lot bought in Balltown. And we were going to build a new house the next year.
Okay.
Because we loved it over there. And all the people over there in the main part of town was about our age. We all played softball. You know, we partied together, snowmobiled together, everything, you know. But then, you know, with Jerry's death, why that just changed everything.
So, do you remember, I don't know what year this was. We went on a trip.
Yeah.
Down to Arkansas.
Arkansas. You and I and Alan, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't remember the year either. All I know is that I won a trip or something on one of these deals, you know. We had to listen to this talk and so forth, so we traveled down to Arkansas. It's the only time I've ever been down there, I think.
Yeah, well, I guess I was one other time later, but that was quite an experience.
Yeah.
But how about, other memories of at the high school at West Dubuque?
Besides the raccoon incident. Well, Dick Smith, you had it. Had interviewed him.
And yeah.
He was always one to give us social studies people a hard time about using audiovisual. And I said, Dick, you're way old fashioned. You got to start doing that. He said, well, I said, if I could get a tape, you know, or film. So I said, Dick, I'll get you one. So I got him a film, and I says, Dick, I says, and that was Keystone always brought those, right. You know. So they brought it. And I didn't show it to Dick. And I says, I'll have it all set up for your class, you know, the next period. So I went in beforehand, and he had the old real projectors, you know, everything. And I set it up, and I called Dick in. And I said, Dick, all you have to do is push this button. He said, what's it about? And I said, oh, don't worry about it. You know, it's on math. You know? So I'll never forget. Afterwards, he came on. He said, God dang you, Alvin. You know, he pushed the button, and the film was in black and white about the 10 little Indians. I said, did you show the whole thing? Well, no.
Well, see, I mean, lots of stuff, but I, you remember, I'm sure, Frank Musel and how structured Frank was as far as his, everything was organized. And so every so often we would have an assembly, and of course the time schedule would be changed. And that always brought Frank up to a frenzy as far as, you know, trying to fit everything in. And so these guys knew that. Well, they made up this fake schedule for Frank. And it was an assembly. And so they put together periods of, I think, 30 minutes and 40 minutes, and then one of 10 minutes, and another with 10. And so they put it in his mailbox. And so everybody's sitting there, and what comes in and pulls it out. What the hell's damn thing is this? He slaps. Oh, yeah.
Well, the best Frank Musel story, though, I heard was when we were trying to improve our ITED scores. And so we were given sample questions for all our different areas, you know, social studies and science and so forth. So Frank gets his. he has the kids go through with these supposedly sample questions, you know, and they figured out all the answers and made sure they had them correct. Well, when the real ITED test came that day, he hands it out. Students start taking a look at it, start working on it. They said, "Mr. Musil, I think this, we got the wrong test." And he says, "Well, why?" And they said, "Well, they're the same questions that we had on the sample one that you gave us yesterday." It's exact. However, he got them mixed up. I don't know.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Oh, break. Oh, yeah.
There were a lot of good times at Western Dubuque. You know, just
oh.
It was. The only thing with Western Dubuque, though, I found, you know, because I started off in the small Catholic school, and now I'm in a small Catholic school again, is the camaraderie wasn't quite as good at Western Dubuque. There was more cliques, I think. You know, you and I recognize that. There were so many, some teachers that we kind of
sure. All
got together real good. Where up at Leo, I mean, we all got together. I mean,
yep. There
was only one other late teacher, and that was Larry McDonough. You might remember him or not, you know. And the rest of them were nuns, but, you know, it was just a real good camaraderie. At Beckman, you know, I'm very much accepted, you know, mm-hmm. over there too. But there was them cliques, and you know who I'm talking about, and different people.
Oh, yeah.
That if you weren't into sports in the school, you weren't anybody, you know, that kind of a clique, you know, stuff like that. And then what I remember most about my class was Little Bobcat today. That was quite a...
Yeah, quite well, a that deal. Was good stuff.
You know, and one time I think I had like 90 little kids running around. That was the most I ever had. And that was kind of...
Yeah, that was yeah. Was that a particular time of the year that you did that, or...?
I did it each semester, and it was usually about halfway through the semester when I covered the development unit. And the first, you know, I started it because I got the feeling that the students really didn't understand the awesome responsibility of raising kids. And so I thought, there's got to be a way to, and I know that they were doing the bag of flowers at one time, remember that, in the family living course,
yeah. You
know, and then they went to the eggs or something like that. But it's not the real thing. So the first time I did Little Bobcat, I was out in the portable, and it was probably maybe my second or third year of teaching psychology. I had my own son, Pete, come. I'll never forget that. I had two classes of psych, the last two of the day. And my Grace, my wife, brought him in at the beginning of the second last period. And he took one look at those students in class, and he got under my desk, and he wouldn't come out. And the students were like, "Hey, you teach this stuff, this kid, you know." Well, between classes, I got a tractor, and I got him going with the tractor, and the class started, and then he wouldn't settle down. He was just all over the place, you know. And before the students left, they says, "How come we can't bring somebody?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, would you be interested?" "Yeah." So then the next semester, I opened it up for the kids from town, you know, so that they'd be nice and close. Well, then the country kids said, "Well, that's not fair. You know, we want to bring them." I said, "Well, yeah, but you've got to drive them here or ride the bus or something." "Yeah, we'll do that." So that's how it got started. And then we did all kinds of testing, but they had to be in charge of that kid all day long.
Yeah.
And the one boy, his name would come to me eventually from around New Vienna area, he wanted to bring a two-year-old. And I says, is she potty trained? "No." And I says, "Well, okay, you can bring her on one condition, that you change your diaper and you take care of her and you don't pawn her off to any other girl in the class." I says, "You got to promise me that." So he says, "Okay, I promise," because he really wanted to bring her. You know, we really couldn't do a whole lot with two-year-olds, but we did some little testing with them. And then we had the testing for the 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, you know. And he came back the next day and he says, "I'm never going to have kids." Never. He says, "My God." He says, "I was so tired by the end of the day." And I said, "Yeah." He said, that's what it's all about. You know, and
because, you know, like every summer we'll have our grandkids for a week or whatever. I don't know how we ever did it. Thank God we were younger when we had our kids, because you're exhausted.
Yeah, are.
As know? Grandparents.
And then when they had to take them to other classes and try to keep them quiet, they had to figure out, you know, what can we do?
Keep them entertained.
Yeah. And then I know one time there was one of the teachers from where the six-year-old was going to school kind of gave the parent a hard time about taking the child out for one day. And the parent looked at the teacher and says, "I think it's more important for my child to have some kind of bonding with an older sibling for one day than it is to be concerned about missing one day of class.
Yeah.
So the parent really thought it was worthwhile. And most teachers were cooperative, and I'm sure it was a hassle for a lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I don't know whether... not too many of them ever come up to me and gave me a hard time about it.
Nope. It was always a popular thing.
Yeah. And I'm stuck... I don't know how long I'll be at Beckman, but I always thought about starting it again, but it's... You're just so much pressed for time, so much stuff to cover nowadays. You know, the textbook that I use now is probably about at least double the amount of information that I had when I was teaching at Horseman View.
What are some of the borders and boundaries that have been passed in psychology as far as you're concerned, from when you started to now?
Well, when I started, I had a book, you know, about 10% or sick is what it is now. And, you know, the topics, homosexuality is an example, wasn't even covered, you know, things like that.
Right.
Tourette's, remember the first case of Tourette's we had?
Yeah.
At Western Dubuque, he was a freshman and came in, we had a meeting, nobody knew what it was.
Yeah.
You know, sleep app, all the sleep disorders. Didn't have any of that information years ago, because sleep labs were brand new. Hell, it wasn't that, you know, Mercy in Dubuque at the time had no sleep lab. You know, that came, Iowa City, we had a girl from Orlington that had narcolepsy, and she shared it with the class. And it took her 7 years for them to properly diagnose her as having narcolepsy. They thought she had cancer and everything else, that she was always falling asleep all the time. She was so tired. Yeah. Well, then finally she went down to the University of Iowa where they had, or the hospital down there, where they had a sleep lab. And within the first 15 minutes, they diagnosed her as narcoleptic.
Wow.
You know? And she was so tired because narcoleptics, they spend all their night dreaming. They never get down to stage 4.
Wow.
So they can sleep 24 hours. So once they put her on a strong stimulant, she could now drive to school without falling asleep, and she wasn't falling asleep in class or anything, you know. So,
good example.
There's just so many topics, you know, that every year, you know, I have to read. I read Scientific America, I read Psychology Today, I read Reader's Digest, and I'm read the daily newspaper, picking out articles that pertain to class. It's just mind-boggling. But yeah. It's good for me. That's why I enjoy it.
Exactly.
It helps me keep my mind a little sharp, trying to keep remembering things. I always tell people my goal is to live to be 90, but I want to know who I am when I'm 90, or else what the hell's the use of living that old, you know?
The boundaries of things you don't know yet about the mind, it's still such a challenging field to...
Well, we just show a beautiful mind. Schizophrenia wasn't heard of back when I started teaching psychology. I
mean, yeah.
Just so many topics, so many labels that have come up that we have to cover nowadays, you know. You know, and the kids this morning, we watched it, and they came in this morning at 6:15 to watch that movie over at Beckman.
Is that right?
They really got some dedicated kids over there. They really, really, I really enjoy... You know, the respect and everything that's happening over there.
How are they? How are they doing on the construction?
They got the chapel and stuff pretty well done, the front part. But then I don't know what else. They won't be done until probably next fall, if by then, by everything. They got a lot to do yet.
Are they opening up some windows or?
No, I don't think so.
Is that right?
No. Which is kind of nice. It, the only problem you have is like today. Now I noticed the kids were there at 6:15. And I went up about, I guess it was about 8:30, I guess, and got some papers from the office. And I come back, and the room was really warm because not a good ventilation system. But there's no distractions, Bob.
Okay.
You know, the only distractions we hear are kids going down the hallway through the doorway. And it's very safe. I mean, the door's locked. It's got wires on the glass. So if any intruder would come in, they'd have a tough time getting in.
Okay.
And so from that point of view, you know, I don't mind it, you know. Because otherwise, you know, the room where I ended up teaching down by the band room, they were cutting grass outside and everything until I went out and complained, you know. I'll never forget up in the old wrestling room. Wow, who the heck was the janitor that come in?
Tony?
Tony came right in during class and went over to the windows and started putting some things on the window right during class. And I says, Tony, I says, can't you possibly wait till after class? God.
And Tony would You know, he had that kind of limp. Yeah, I get a bad hip. So he'd come limping up the hallway, and so we'd visit, and he'd lean up against the hall or the wall or the door, and he says, you know, he says, I try to do as much as I can. He says, I tell them, but they never listen to me. how things should be done. Oh, God. Yes, indeed, that was...
Well, then the other experience that I had that none of the other teachers had was in psychology, in human development, the chapter you start from, which today is called preconception, which I didn't have back then when I had the psychology course first put in, and then you end up with death, you know. So I taught some things on death and the five stages of death and dying that are used in various ways and so forth, you know. And I kept thinking, how can you get these kids really serious about what happens afterwards? So I went in, and I'll never forget, I asked Harold, I says, would it be okay if I had Bob Reich bring down a casket and put it in my classroom? He kind of looked at me at first, and he says, you've got a promise, there won't be anybody in it. And I says, come on, Harold, you know, I'm not going to do that, you know. So anyway, so I called Bob, and I told him what I wanted and why. And he says, yeah, he says, Dan, I'll come down. So that was when I had in the old wrestling room there. So he backed up to those doors, you know, yeah. And brought the casket in. And I didn't tell the kids I was going to do this. So the kids come in that day and they see this casket.
You know, I don't remember that.
Don't you?
No.
Oh, and they looked and they said, what's going on? And I says, we're covering the topic death and dying today. And I just thought I'd bring a speaker in, you know. So they came in and they were super quiet, you know. And so Bob gets and he starts talking, you know, And then I says, well, I wonder how many here would like to see the inside of one, the whole inside, because when you go to awake, you know, you just see half. And they all raise their hands. So we opened up the casket, you know, and so forth. And the kids had fantastic, you know, questions. One question I'll never forget they asked Bob was they said, well, what if a person wants to take all their money with them? You know, what do you do then? And Bob, in all seriousness, says, he says, that's not a problem. He says, right before I close the casket, he says, I'll write a check out for the amount of money and then I'll keep the cash. And of course, the kids were sitting there and it never hit them until a little while later.
That's awesome.
And then, that same day, well, remember the old Butts florist from Epworth?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, they were bringing flowers over for what, I don't forget what the occasion was, but they come over to school. And they came back through that back door, they always did, you know,
yeah.
Back. And they saw the hearse there. And they walk inside, and the kids are happy-go-lucky and all this stuff. And they said, what's going on? What happened that, you know, here the hearse is, and yet the kids are just so happy and everything. They didn't know that I had a guest speaker.
Oh, my.
So then after that, I think I might have had them maybe one more time bring the casket down. And then finally I said to Bob, I says, well, he's a... possible that we could come to your funeral home, then you could show them the embalming room, you know, and everything like that. And he says, yeah, Danny said, that'd be fantastic, because he had a large number of caskets, and then we had sure. The kids come, and he would open up the caskets and show them the Z-barding and the warranties and the bed and everything, you know, and he explained everything very thoroughly. So then he takes them into the embalming room, and, you know, you learn a lot from mistakes or experiences, and all of a sudden, I happen to just look across at the gal on the other side of the embalming room, and her face is real white, and before I got over to her, she collapses. So I went over, and I grabbed and tried to pick her up. I got her up, and Bob says, there's a door right there. Somebody, one of the kids opened it, got her outside, but then she fainted. You know, after that, then I'd tell the students, and we've been doing this for, I don't know, probably 40 years now, I suppose. I tell them, you know, if you feel faint, have a partner that you can tell. And I says, if they think this is going to bother you, just kind of stand up by me and then I'll.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to go through it, you don't have to. And, you know, kids are extremely strong and resilient, because I had a girl one year that she buried her father on Monday. And on Wednesday, we had the funeral home visit. And at class on Tuesday, she says, I don't know if I can do this. And I says, well, I says, I'd really like you to go so that you have more knowledge about what happened after your father passed away. And I said, I want you to stay close to me when we're over at the funeral home. And I says, we'll have some tissues, and if you feel it's too heavy for you, I says, I'll take you outside. Well, she stayed, you know, in the whole presentation. And when she came to class the next day, I says, well, how'd it go? And she says, I'm really glad I went. She says, I really feel great about the way they took care of my dad.
Wow.
So that was a kind of a unique situation.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And I usually don't mention too many names because I'm just kind of used to doing that. I don't. I give a lot of examples and stories when I teach, but I don't. The only names I give when I teach are my kids. I use my kids a lot in examples in class.
Okay.
You know, but otherwise I just say I know so and so. You know, because we just got through talking about schizophrenia in class, and I've had two students. One that was diagnosed when she was in. A senior, and the other one, he's in research down at the University of Iowa, down in the hospital down there, is a schizophrenic.
Okay.
And then there's a bipolar one that's doing very well. Another bipolar one that's doing very well.
So that's got to be a tough one too.
Not as bad as schizophrenia, Bob. That schizophrenia is that if you've seen Beautiful Mind at all.
Yes.
You know,
yep.
I mean, that is, you know, the voices. How do they? I mean, the kids sat in class this morning, and I told them afterwards, I said, this is the most involved class I've ever seen since I've been shown this movie. They were sitting there on needles and pins when the scene come where the baby was in the bathtub, and the water was running, and the baby could have drowned. You know, they were going like this, you know, like, oh, you know.
Yeah.
Sure. And and I said, you know, you people just got so involved in this. But I says, how many of you were confused about what's real and what's not real? And they all raised their hand. And I said, that's what these people go through every day in life. I says, how can you tell? How do you know if the voice? Because we all have this little voice sometimes that we call conscience, you know, kind of that tells us, well, that's right or that's not right. You know, I'm talking about that little voice coming. But I says, if you couldn't tell that that's a voice within you, but it's telling you to do something, like Andrea Yates, we talked about her and how she drowned those five kids of hers, you know, and stuff.
Yeah.
I says, how can you? So I said, who were the people that were in the movie that were real? Well, so and so. I said, are you sure that person was real? Well, I don't know now. So that's a great movie to help them understand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So when they hear or see articles in the paper and it says that so and so, you know, was found committing a crime and he heard voices, I says, now you understand to some degree, you know, what these people are going through. To me, that's the worst. Worst mental disorder you can get, Bob, is schizophrenia.
Yeah, that's got to be unbelievable.
Yeah. I got to take a break.
Yeah. Yeah, just...